From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, when Teddy Roosevelt came to San Antonio to form the Rough Riders, he changed the course of American foreign policy and sparked America's love affair with military might. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In downtown San Antonio, in Alamo Plaza, there's a statue of Teddy Roosevelt on horseback. A wayward tourist might be confused by seeing the 26th president presented at the historic Texas battleground. After all, TR did not fight for Texas independence. He fought for Cuba's independence in the Spanish-American War with his band of volunteers, the Rough Riders, which were formed in San Antonio. Currently, in this climate of tearing down statues, this depiction of Roosevelt is safe, but in New York City, in front of the Museum of Natural History, it is not. It's coming down. I spoke with author Clay Risen about that.
Probably more than any other institution in America, it's the one most closely tied to the Roosevelt family. Theodore Roosevelt's father was integral to the process of starting it, and then Roosevelt himself was a committed advocate of the museum, and also, you know, his collections from various hunting trips around the country and in Africa helped populate a lot of the displays that even today we kind of look at as the core of their collection.
The statue has Teddy Roosevelt on a horse. On one side of him, behind him, is an indigenous person, male, and then there is an African-American slave male to the other side of him. People see that statue, and what they interpret it as, that these people are being portrayed in a negative light.
That's right. There's, especially when you look at it without any context at all, it's a very, I think a lot of people find it a very disturbing image. It's clearly a person, an indigenous person, a Native American. What exactly the man next to him on the other side is he an enslaved American? Is he simply an African American? Is he African? There are different interpretations of the statue, and one of them is that Roosevelt represents America as it's understood as sort of an Anglo-Saxon country, leading two other civilizations or two other peoples forward. And that, so Africans generally, or people of African descent, indigenous people generally. And, I think if you look at it that way, it certainly can be read as something that's imperialist, if not white supremacist. I think it's hard, especially if you don't know the context, not to see it that way. And that's what has so many people up in arms.
Clay Risen is the author of a new book about Teddy Roosevelt that focuses on his time with the Rough Riders and the impact that experience had on his presidential policy making and the reshaping of American attitudes about military power and the United States' place on the world stage. The book is The Crowded Hour, Teddy Roosevelt, The Rough Riders, and the Dawn of the American Century. Why did we need the Rough Riders? Why would the nation want a bunch of scallywags and rich kids, polo players, to come along and join the military and help win a war?
Let me start with kind of the sort of more mundane reason is that, when we got into a war with Spain, we sort of declared war, the United States declared war, and sort of didn't account for the fact that we really didn't have an army. We'd had this huge army to fight the Civil War, and then it had been starved of resources sort of ever since then, over several decades. And, on purpose, the country was a violent place, but it was not a militaristic place. And so and there's a real fear of what large armies would do. So by law, an act of Congress, the army could not be larger than about 26,000 soldiers. And then couple of thousand officers. And, that worked in peacetime. We were an isolationist country. We were very isolated, Canada to our north and Mexico to our south, and really nothing anywhere else. And then we get into a war with, over Cuba, with Spain. And we had by then a decent sized Navy, but we had really nothing in terms of an army, and most of the army was spread around the country in small units. So it's not even that it's not just that we didn't have an army. We didn't have an army that knew how to fight as an army. And so Theodore Roosevelt comes along and he proposed the idea of, you know, building a volunteer regiment. And actually there were three of these. One of them was the Rough Riders. The other two were sort of they never really got off the ground. But his idea was that, you know, we can raise a volunteer army and that would be fine. But it will take a long time. And a lot of these volunteers are going to be cannon fodder because, you know, they're not experienced. They have no experience in any of the things that go into war fighting. And Roosevelt's insight, which is kind of insane when you think about it, but is quite clever, is that while there might not be a lot of soldiers out there, there are a lot of people in America who had the sorts of skills that go into being a soldier. So cowboys, right? They're not soldiers, but they know how to rough it. They know how to ride a horse. They know how to shoot a gun. College athletes might not be, you know, particularly savvy with a gun, but they probably have a good amount of physical skill, a good amount of kind of self-denial, the sort of soldierly qualities. And, you know, all the other people that went into the Rough Riders, you know, you had cops, you had miners, you had some veterans. And, you know, so you end up with this kind of dirty dozen, but it's 1,000 people. And, you know, in the same way, the Dirty Dozen is sort of this ragtag group of guys who happen to have certain skills. The Rough Riders is the same idea. And, you know, I often say, you know, when I'm talking about this, that, you know, if this story had not actually happened, someone would have invented it, because it is exactly the kind of, you know, ragtag, scallywag story that we as a, you know, sort of that our culture loves. And Teddy Roosevelt just happened to create it.
So the fact that the United States at the time did not have this large standing army was reflective of how the United States saw its place in the world at the time, and post the Spanish-American War, how that view changed.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the country had been isolationist, particularly after the Civil War, where the experience was so searing and so just it left a great scar on the country, and particularly on its political leadership. You know, every president from Grant up until McKinley served in the Civil War. And aside from Grant, most of them had really started their careers as officers or soldiers in the war. And that was true also for senators and governors. You had this whole political class that came out of the Civil War scarred by the experience. And part of what they decided was, and part of really what guided the Republican Party, you know, which was, I mean, the Democrats were really nothing compared to the power of the Republicans and the dominance in that part of the 19th century. And one of the things that, you know, that really guided the party was, you know, just being isolationist, you know, or at least really not trying to engage with the world any more than necessary, really trying to keep our commitments to the world as small as possible. And then you have a new generation come along. And this is why Theodore Roosevelt is so important as a figure, because he saw, and his generation saw, things fundamentally differently. For Roosevelt, not only did he embody, did he grow up with a certain romantic vision of war and manhood, but he also had a great faith in the United States as not just as a country, but as a world power. And as a young man, you know, I'd say, you know, up until the time he went into the Spanish-American War, you know, he had a very aggressive vision for the world, for the United States and the world. You know, he wanted to go to war. He had a list of countries that he thought the United States should go to war with, starting with Germany. Japan was up there, and for no other reason than just to go to war. It was a very, you know, pretty arrogant and juvenile view of the world. But as president, and I think the war is important in this transition, you know, as president, he developed a much more sophisticated view. And as president, he, I think, set the tone for the way America saw itself through the 20th century, really more as a policeman, as, you know, to some extent, you'd call it an imperialist, but, you know, a country that tried to shape the world in its vision in a positive way. And And to take the founding values of the United States, those constitutional values, the ideas that sort of sit at the core of what we like to think define the country, and bring them to the rest of the world. And that transition, I think, is you really can't understand that transition that the country made, that Roosevelt himself made, you know, if you don't understand what happened during the Spanish-American War and how that experience both brought together a lot of changes that were starting to happen across the country and in our culture, but also created a whole new set of challenges and expectations that played out in the United States and in our role in the world throughout the 20th century.
How famous was Roosevelt at the time to the general public?
He was decently well known, not anything like what he would become. And certainly the war gave him a level of celebrity that he could probably never have imagined getting, you know, just 6 months before. He had established himself through a variety of careers. You know, he definitely kind of bounced around. You know, he was he owned a ranch. He was a member of the New York State Assembly. He was political sort of appointee in Washington as a, you know, civil service commissioner. He was, you know, helped run the New York City Police, and then obviously ended up in the Department of the Navy. And this is all a kind of disparate career. And he did well in all the jobs. He actually wasn't that great a rancher, but he did well enough. He did well in all of them, but none of it really stuck as a career. The thing that actually made him best known as a public figure was his writing. He wrote tons and tons of books. He wrote a 4-part history of the West. He wrote biographies. He wrote a lot on conservation, along with books that he would write. He would also write newspaper sort of journal articles. He would write letters that were published in journals. And so he really developed a name that way. He was well known in New York for his politics, for his political career, but outside he was best known as a writer, as a, you know, something of an intellectual, certainly as a journalist and a historian. And, you know, that probably, if he had never gone to war, if he had really sort of never gone deeper into politics, today that's what we would know Theodore Roosevelt as, someone who wrote histories. And to be honest, most of his histories don't stand up these days. You know, they definitely were of their time. And so I think we'd look back and kind of faintly remember who Theodore Roosevelt was. But then he goes off to war and he's well known enough where, you know, people say, oh, you know, this guy, he's putting together a regiment of ragtag volunteers to go off to fight. This is a great story. And so that's what helped make the Rough Riders just sort of overnight this incredible media story. You know, aside from everything they did in Cuba, from the very beginning, they were seen as kind of the story to tell about the Spanish-American War.
So he comes to San Antonio to form the Rough Riders. The local legend is that he organized the Rough Riders while sitting in the Minger Hotel bar. Although he was a teetotaler, didn't really order anything, any spirits there. Is that part true?
You know, the reality is he organized the Rough Riders in Washington. That was where it was created. It was most of the commissions were handed out from Washington. That said, I have no doubt that he did business in terms of processing members of the Rough Riders there in the Manger. You know, the fact that it was a bar was convenient, but it's also, you know, at the time it was the place to be. I mean, I've been to the Manger these days, and it's a wonderful hotel. But you know, back then it was considered, you know, by far the best place to be, whether it was socializing or to stay. And so for him to be there, it was sort of a natural, right? Of course, Theodore Roosevelt's going to set up shop at the Manger. Now, you know, the extent to which he was there and not at camp, I think is probably lost to history. You know, great story about the Manger. When Theodore Roosevelt arrived in town, he was one of the last, well, not one of the last, but he arrived late. The regiment was already forming. He had to finish some business in D.C. And when he came to San Antonio, he arrived and he got a room at the Manger to just take a shower or take a bath and, you know, clean up, and then he'd go out and meet the men. And the manager of the Manger said, well, you know, you're Theodore Roosevelt. We would like to offer you, you know, free room and board. You stay with us, you know, get a good night's sleep, get a good meal, wash up, in the morning you can go out with the men, come back and, you know, wash up and you can be here. And Theodore Roosevelt said, well, you know, look, I really appreciate it. He was very polite. Roosevelt was always an incredibly polite man. Everyone said his manners were impeccable. And he said, you know, I really appreciate it, but this is the thing. I have to be with my men, and I will not do anything that they won't do, and I do not will never do anything that makes it appear that I'm better than they are. And that was how he saw his entire role, the entire short career in the military. He always treated his soldiers, whether they were the youngest, most inexperienced, lowest ranked privates, whatever they were, he put himself on their level. And later on, when he was they were taking trains from San Antonio to Tampa, where they were going to board ships, someone, you know, sort of the arrangement emerged that he would get a cabin there in the train. And he said, no, you know, let's that cabin, we'll use it for sick soldiers. So a soldier that's sick gets to stay in the cabin, because otherwise you had to just stretch out on luggage. And so Roosevelt, just the whole trip, just camped on the luggage, just with the rest of the men, because he refused to take the opportunity to see himself as some, or to be, you know, sort of take the comforts of rank. And, you know, instead he made sure that he was right there in the thick the whole time.
So they did train in San Antonio, the Rough Riders. They mustered here from across mm-hmm. the country. They were at where we now have Roosevelt Park, City Park. Mm-hmm. What was it like at the scene? Reading newspaper accounts from the time, which I know you've done to do your research, and I've read them out of curiosity. It was like a media circus. Every day, new stories are coming. Reporters were coming to TR and asking him about his thoughts about the world and what's happening, this and that and the other thing. And they were having band concerts. So there's a story about a band concert that they had at one of the last days of camping and training. And what happened?
So there was a famous, or he was locally famous, a famous conductor. And he offered to bring his band out, and they would play music, and the Rough Riders would get to listen to it, as well as the whole city basically turned out for this. And they played a cavalry sort of, you know, an upbeat kind of cavalry piece.
It's the Cavalry Charge.
Yeah, it's a Cavalry Charge. And in it, there's actually, there are supposed to be, or there, he wanted there to be gunshots. And, when they start playing, the men all pulled out their guns and started shooting up in the air. And for reasons that are unclear, may have to do with the shooting, maybe coincidental, the lights all went out. There was electric lighting strung around the event. And the lights all went out. And so there's pandemonium and people start screaming and running everywhere. And, you know, there was a lot of blame to go around afterward as to who caused the pandemonium. But it really, you know, it's one of those stories that then elevated very quickly to being, characterizing what the Rough Riders were. You know, there's a lot of fun stories about the Rough Riders being kind of crazy, but they were actually very, very serious about their job. And one of the things that I think is a testament to Roosevelt's professionalism and his achievements as a leader was that he got all these guys who were not necessarily given to following orders. And he very quickly put together a pretty effective fighting force. I mean, they proved themselves on the battlefield. And, you know, they by and large were very committed to their job, very committed to their role. That said, every night at camp, after they were, you know, they sort of played taps, good number of Rough Riders would sneak out of camp and head into San Antonio to drink and then stumble home late at night to be ready for muster in the morning.
Teddy Roosevelt didn't really understand or know a lot about how to train a outfit. He had to learn it out of a book while he was doing it.
Yeah. I mean, another thing about leadership that I think Roosevelt showed showed his sort of natural inclination is a willingness to admit what he didn't know and then to learn very quickly and to figure out who were the people who could tell him, you know, that he could learn from. And so, he and his, you know, the man who was really in charge of the unit, but not the face of the unit, was his best friend, Leonard Wood, who had, he was a Medal of Honor winner. He had fought in the Southwest and in various Indian conflicts, and had ended up as the surgeon for the president, the White House physician. But they were best friends, and they kind of came up with this idea of the Rough Riders. And so Leonard Wood was in charge, and Roosevelt was, you know, the guy kind of running things day to day. And, you know, so Leonard Wood was would sort of tell Roosevelt certain things. He was a, you know, trained soldier, but also the two of them picked very good majors sort of lower ranking officers who were mostly veterans. And Roosevelt would turn to those guys every day with long lists of questions. You know, he would do his homework and he would read through these training manuals and cavalry guides. And then he would go to these officers and he would say, okay, well, here are the questions I have. So this says this, what about, you know, here's a scenario, what do I do? And constantly peppering them. And then when he would make mistakes, asking them what he did wrong, so that he was learning this whole time in a very humble and open way, which I think, you know, a lot of people who find themselves in leadership positions that they don't know how to deal with and sort of in over their head, a lot of times the inclination is to pretend and bluster and sort of say, well, of course I know what's going on. I'm in charge, right? Sort of a lack of confidence. Roosevelt had no lack of confidence. He had enough confidence to say, you know, I'm in charge and here's what I don't know. And I need you to tell me what I know. You know, I need you to educate me. And it's just a stunning display of a leadership quality that you don't often find.
When he was in San Antonio, that's where he got a couple of his horses and a Stetson cowboy hat where he sewed his glasses into the hat.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, there's a certain Boy Scout element to Teddy Roosevelt. And one of them is, he had very bad vision. I mean, he really couldn't see without his glasses. So the idea of going off to war and being in battle and who knows what's going to happen, you don't want to suddenly be without glasses. And so Roosevelt had, his hat was fitted with all these sort of compartments and pockets and bands where he could put spare pairs of glasses in case he broke or lost one of his pairs when he was riding or when he was in battle.
The Rough Riders show up and they do what? Are they part of a army's battle plan or they just go freelance looking for Spanish to engage?
No, they were very much a part of the plan. There was a mix of mostly regular army units and then a few volunteer regiments. And the Rough Riders were one of those. They were embedded. They were attached to a cavalry brigade. There were two divisions of infantry and one division of cavalry. And the Rough Riders were part of the ranks of that cavalry division. And they were deployed as any other regiment would be. It's a real, again, that's another testament to Roosevelt and Wood's leadership is, you know, these other, they were fighting alongside professional soldiers, some of whom had been at least in the military. I mean, they didn't really have battle experience, but they've been in the military for years. And here are these guys who, you know, just a few months earlier were, herding cattle or playing football or whatever they were doing. And they're fighting right alongside them and actually doing really well. There was an initial battle. There was a first battle a few days after they landed. And there's a great question of how well will the Rough Riders do? The Rough Riders played a pretty central part in this battle. And it was an intense battle. The Spanish at one point really did have an upper hand, but the Rough Riders did fantastically well, and the American side won that battle. And you know, it helped a lot that there were reporters embedded with the Rough Riders who were very very fond of the Rough Riders who filed dispatches. And it just exploded in the United States, the story of this battle, which, to be honest, was not a big battle. It was, you know, just one step up from a skirmish. I think 9 Rough Riders were killed and, you know, it was and a lot and several were wounded. So it wasn't nothing. And it became just the big story. Suddenly, not only did they win this battle, this was the first, you know, the first American victory on, you know, over on an overseas war, even though it's not, you know, it's across the Florida Strait. It's not really overseas. But so it was a big moment for the country. But the fact that the Rough Riders were so central to it, just that sort of just really solidified their celebrity. And of course, it made Roosevelt a national hero overnight.
What was the significance of winning the Spanish-American War? The United States was able to gain possession of Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Philippines all at once. Now the United States was an international empire.
It had two effects. The first was to really sort of bring to an end the idea that America could ever be truly isolated from the world. It didn't bring to an end isolationism. There were many periods of isolationism in the 20th century.
We might have one now.
We might have one now, sure. But just the idea that America could not be engaged with the world, that we actually now, you know, we controlled territory around the world. There was no way that we could just sort of give that up. At the same time, it introduced a new set of questions, and really questions that I don't think even today we've answered, which is for a country, a powerful country like the United States, what is that role that the United States is supposed to play? This came to a head very quickly in the Philippines, because while we were committed to getting out of Cuba, and while we just sort of everyone agreed not to talk about Puerto Rico, the Philippines immediately turned into an insurgent war against the United States. Now, we had not planned on taking the Philippines. It was sort of incidental. And so suddenly we're doing these things that we had always told ourselves we would never do, play these imperial games. Meanwhile, the Filipinos are pushing, you know, they're unhappy with the fact that, you know, they sort of suddenly traded one imperial ruler for another. And we ended up doing some of the things, very same things to the Filipinos that we had been so shocked to see the Spanish do against the Cubans, you know, mass executions, you know, concentration camps, brutal treatment of the rebels, and I shouldn't say rebels, insurgents. And it was a reckoning at home. There was a very strong anti-imperialist movement, you know, led by, you know, among others, Mark Twain. And they were deeply critical of Roosevelt because Roosevelt by then was president and he refused to give up the Philippines. And a lot of people who had been very supportive of the idealism that took us into the Spanish-American War were suddenly chastened by the reality of being this sort of despised global power almost overnight. And, you know, so the fighting in the Philippines ended. We obviously did not leave the Philippines. We didn't leave until after World War II. And even after that, maintained a lot of control over the country. But the question remained, you know, is there a good way to be a global power? Can you be a country that espouses values and not immediately undermine them if you're out there in the world trying to do good? You know, what, there's so many ironies and contradictions and hypocrisies. That was immediately apparent, and it has never left us. That's always been the question. It was the question in Vietnam. It was the question in Iraq. If we go in with good intentions, does that outweigh the almost necessary evil that we will commit when we are occupying a country?
Clay Risen is the New York Times deputy op-ed editor and author of The Crowded Hour, Teddy Roosevelt, The Rough Riders, and the Dawn of the American Century. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters episodes, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.